From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The state of Utah has been fine-tuning its case against gay marriage. As you know, a federal judge has ruled the state's ban on these marriages unconstitutional, and the state's legal team is working out a strategy in the appeal. In a brief filed last week, the central case became clear. The focus is going to be on children. And here's the essence of that case, that there is a body of social science research that confirms children simply fare better in homes where they have a mother and a father, which Utah officials say doesn't demean same-sex families. It's just that the state has an interest in preserving this ideal arrangement. So today in the program, we're talking about the state's claim, the legal dynamics, but also the question at the heart of it. Just what is the ideal family for kids? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the state of Utah's evolving attempt to preserve the ban on same-sex marriage. You're familiar with the basics by now. A federal judge struck down the ban in late December. The U.S. Supreme Court stayed that ruling so Utah could appeal it. Last week, the legal strategy started to come into focus when state lawyers filed a brief in that case. Utah seems to have shifted its focus in making its case that it has an interest in keeping marriage an institution for one man and one woman. But Utah is no longer focused on tradition and procreation so much as they're focused on children. They're going to be arguing children simply fare better in homes where they have a mother and a father. So we're talking about that contention today, as well as some of the legal dynamics in the case. And we invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Paul Merrow is back with us, president of Sutherland Institute. It's a conservative public policy think tank based here in Salt Lake City. He is a co-author of a book called The Natural Family, a Manifesto. The Sutherland Institute, of course, has been publishing extensively on traditional and same-sex marriage. It goes without saying, they support the state's case defending Amendment 3. And Paul Merrow, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug, for having me.
How do you describe, let's start with this, Sutherland's role in respect to the state's case? What sort of role are you playing?
Oh, it's not unlike, I guess, any outside advocate role. After the state kind of bungled the Shelby case.
I want to get into that, by the way.
Sure.
Your contention that they blew it, I think, is fair to put it. But just keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. You know, after that, our interest at Sutherland, of course, was to make sure that we had the right counsel in place as we move forward. And more importantly, if there is a more important than the right counsel, the right strategy. And so, you know, we have a public voice, and we just shared that wherever we could.
I want to get this out of the way because it did come up, and I wanted to give you a chance to publicly respond, although you've been quoted in the paper in responding. But one of the attorneys hired to defend Utah's ban on same-sex marriage is Gene Scherer.
Yeah.
Jim DeBacchus, as you know, state senator, head of the Democratic Party, called that a conflict of interest. He said that his relationship with your organization was this breach of ethics.
Yeah.
Says you're paying Scherer. He says Scherer's basically been lobbying state lawmakers on your behalf, he has said, not to consider any bills related to same-sex relationships. Your response to that?
Yeah, we have no formal agreement with Gene Scherer. We have a verbal tentative agreement to bring him on as a fellow after the case is done, when the last brief is filed. And at that point, he'll come on as a fellow to Sutherland, and we'll pay him to do a couple of papers that we hope are the definitive voice for attorneys across the country that have to deal with this issue, and also for legislators in state legislatures that have to deal with this issue. So
But you're not paying him now to sort of get under the tent and lobby
lawmakers. And I think, Doug, the other thing, too, is we oppose the moratorium. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know what Senator Dukakis is really saying.
So let's go to the point you were making earlier. Okay. The case that they bungled was the word you said. I was going to say they sort of blew it. What was the thing that they got wrong in essence?
The thing that they got wrong perhaps wasn't their fault, honestly. All of this up to December 20th is happening kind of in the middle of the swallow chaos inside the Attorney General's office.
So a lot of distractions.
A lot of distractions going on. And honestly, the AG's office doesn't have staff in place, which is why they went to outside counsel. They don't have staff in place to really handle the appellate process, first of all, but they really don't have staff in place who have marriage and family law in their DNA. And that's really what was missing. In other words, you know, we all know when we're pleading with our spouse, we're pleading with a neighbor, a friend, anybody, you know, it pays to be passionate about something and to, you know, to let the other person really feel it, not just hear what you're saying, but feel what you're saying.
So, but what do you mean? That the state was kind of ambivalent about it all in some way? Not as engaged as that you think they should have been?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, they just weren't as engaged as they should have been. I don't think that the brief and the oral arguments before Judge Shelby were up to par. I certainly think the plaintiff's counsel opened herself up to so many opportunities for the state to just look at the judge and say, really, you believe that? I can't believe you believe that. And then go on and take those
So they missed opportunities
on.
In those
oh,
cases.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting. One of the there are a number of these kind of pillars that the state had used. One of them was this idea of responsible procreation, that the traditional definition of marriage reinforced what they call responsible procreation.
Yeah.
Judge Shelby, of course, said, look, the ability to procreate, that's not relevant in a relevant way anyway to differentiate same-sex or opposite-sex couples. So the state, it seems like they've ditched that. Was that a mistake to do it in the first place? Are you glad they've gotten rid of that argument as a focus?
No, and I don't think they got rid of it.
They're just
Again, a lot of it is just the expertise of the attorneys involved who are able to create a broader, deeper, richer context.
Is that a good argument, the procreation one, for you?
Well, yeah. Well,
whether it's up front or not.
Let me tell you, it has to be, and not that it's wherever it exists in the ranking of arguments that you make, I think it has to be there.
Why? I mean, Shelby says, what's the difference? They can have babies or not.
Yeah, I know, but Judge Shelby's context is different than the state's, and this to me is really the dividing line. You know, Judge Shelby doesn't see a state interest in marriage. He only sees a state interest in the individual rights of consenting adults. And actually, there is no state interest in that. I mean, it's just like, so what does that mean? Consenting adults now, any consenting adults should be allowed to marry? You know, you didn't have to go there, but the fact that he just got rid of the state interest entirely, and we can talk about the state interest in a minute, but the fact that he just set that aside and said, you know, I'm not hearing any compelling rational argument from the state, because frankly, my Judge Shelby brain doesn't see what you see. All I see are individuals with a liberty interest that trumps anything that anybody could argue.
Now, you've called that selfish.
I've called that selfish individualism.
Selfish individualism. I sort of see that a lot in your writing. That seems to be something you keep coming back to.
Yeah,
why?
Yeah. Well, because Utah is a mixture politically of a few things. And kind of the progressive left certainly believes that the individual is the fundamental unit of society. But so does the progressive right, meaning the libertarian element. Mm-hmm. They believe that the individual is the fundamental unit of society. And while human autonomy and individual rights are certainly just, you know, part and parcel of what it means to be an American, just using an example of like traffic laws. I mean, we all love driving in our own cars and driving as fast as we want to and going where we want to, when we want to. We don't like the guy that cut in front of it, but we have to have rules when we start driving on the same freeway. And in that sense, that's a state interest.
But where is the rule for a heterosexual couple who they've been divorced in the past,
right.
They've had domestic abuse problems, they've had alcohol problems, they're terrible at it.
Yeah.
There's no state interest that says you can't get married. They have access to the institution.
Right, because the state interest isn't about the relationship per se. The state interest is in the structure. The state interest is in this situation where you have the complementarity between a man and a woman. Whether they choose, we let men and women get married, right? Except under really extreme circumstances, right?
Right.
And so the state encourages male-female marriage. It does so even without any commitment from the man and woman to procreate.
Yep.
Right? And even if the male and female are lack the ability to conceive, right?
Which is right?
We do that. Well, yes. Yeah,
okay.
you have to do that because the state interest is about ordered liberty, Doug.
Yeah.
Again, marriage is just – marriage and I call it the natural family, the traditional family, is just a component of how you structure ordered liberty in a free society. You want to encourage in this case family structures that maintain ordered liberty. And what do you mean by
family structures? Because Shelby said, look, if you
I'll give you an example.
Give me an example because yeah. One of the things that I noticed is Shelby said basically that in his December decision, he said the ability to procreate, I'll go back to that. He said is not he said forbidding gay
is not in fact a basis to be married.
Right. But the thing that I want to get back to though is he says that by forbidding gay and lesbian couples to marry, he said the state reinforces a norm that sexual activity may take place out of marriage. You don't let gay people get, then they're going to have, don't you want people to be committed to each other, to, you know, sexual relationships within a certain parameter? I mean, so I guess what I'm not understanding is what you mean by, I mean, what is your interest? What is this order of thing that you're talking about?
Ordered liberty.
Ordered liberty.
Yeah, which is not a unique concept to Paul Miro. I mean, that's been there since the founding of the nation. So ordered liberty is that balance between individual autonomy, human autonomy, and what you have to do to live peacefully and prosperously in a free society. Again, I use the traffic situation, but let me come back because I think a lot of, and I'm not sure in the short time that we have here that I'm going to be able to really answer every question you have. But I think a lot of issues get conflated here, and they get all bound together in a complicated way that doesn't have to be complicated. So let me just take one aspect. Say a loving, committed relationship, because that's the language that the plaintiffs argued should be the standard as the definition of marriage, a loving, committed relationship. Yeah. And Judge Shelby glommed right on to that.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So an example that I've used before is, both of my elderly parents and my disabled sister live with me. So I'm going to pick on my dad for the moment. He has... he has dementia. And I take care of my dad. He lives with me. I feed my dad. I pay his bills. I am his health care legal proxy. I love my dad and I'm committed to my dad, but I'm not married to my dad. Okay, so marriage is something more than just being loving and committed to somebody. And certainly—
What is it? What is it? What's the difference?
The difference is that is a comprehensive union, where it's not you just don't add sex to it, but you add that complementarity to it between a man and a woman.
But why can't gay people have that? Why can't they be in that?
Well, because there's no complementarity between you and me, Doug. We are, I mean, beyond the radio, but in our personal, intimate lives, there's no complementarity between two men.
Are you saying it's unnatural? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying it's unnatural. I'm saying there's no complementarity to it. I have male friends, and that's completely natural for me to have male friends, as do you. So there's not, it's not an unnatural kind of a thing.
Isn't part of your argument, that it's unnatural?
No, it's not. Just because, by the way, just because I use the term natural family,
right,
doesn't mean, and I think we had this conversation maybe 6-7 years ago with the Knab thing, but it doesn't mean that something else is it doesn't mean, for instance, and the state brief points this out, that if a student gets an A on their paper, that everything else is to be demeaned as not normal, natural, or healthy, or whatever.
But it seems like, though, Paul, that you've got to go further than that. The state is saying, look, this is not designed to demean other family structures any more than, as they say, giving an A to some students demean others.
Right.
And what the state is saying there is, this is the ideal. This is our interest.
Yeah.
Right?
What the state is saying is, I mean, you can use the word ideal if you want, but what the state is saying, this is our state interest. In fact, of all the things
we
can
think about. But
what is
our state interest? An ideal relationship, right?
It's more than the ideal. It's the very mainstream thread of civilization. If it's an ideal, it's an ideal that's being met constantly. Let me just put it that way. I just don't want to get hung up on the word ideal.
Okay.
I'd rather we get hung up on the idea of a state interest, because the state interest really isn't that you married your wife and I married Sally. I'm sorry, I don't know your wife's name, but anyway, that I married Sally. You know, I could have married Becky, Bonnie, you know, whatever. So the state really doesn't care about that. The state does care in ordered liberty, civilization, and futurity. So in other words, it has an interest in the natural joining of a man and a woman, and this gets back to your procreation element.
Yeah.
The state has an interest in that. The state has an interest in a sterile male and female marrying and adopting children. The state has an interest in that. And it's because of that complementarity more than it is this natural biological childbirth. Although you're going to do a show, I think, on social science aspects of all of this. But
I want to ask you about the social science component of it. Is that relevant to you? Is that significant?
Well,
it seems like you don't really.
I don't need it to make my argument.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But
it seems like the state is banking on that to make an argument. They're saying that there is a big body of information
mostly because the plaintiffs are banking on it. Mostly because. See, and this is what was real interesting about how the arguments were crafted.
But your case is hard to make, isn't it?
No, the other side is hard to make.
Really?
Ours is pretty easy to make because we have millennia of human experience to make it. And the plaintiffs struggle a little bit, but they're very clever. So they claim the 14th Amendment is really addressing just the individual liberties of consenting adults on the one hand, and that lets them avoid what should be their burden in court, which is if they're saying that there's no material or substantive difference between same-sex marriage and opposite-sex marriage, well, if we have millennia of evidence showing that actually, you know, our side helps that state interest, helps civilization, helps futurity, it seems to me that they ought to be able to show some evidence and burden on their part to say, yeah, we do too. We benefit society too. So I hope whoever you interview next, you ask them that. What's the state interest in same-sex marriage? Not in individual liberties, not in adult-centric psychological relationships. What's the state interest in same-sex marriage?
I do want to, before we run out of time, I want to get to the matter of social science. One of the things that's been pointed out by a guest who's coming on the program, Professor Roski of the University of Utah, is that the studies that are cited by the state that they're relying on And I'm wondering if these also include some studies that you may trust. They do not include an evaluation of same-sex parents who are raising kids. That they're comparing heterosexual couples.
Yeah.
This, you know, good old American heterosexual couples, yeah, against the crappy ones, against, yeah, the divorced ones, and about the ones, right, who are single moms.
No,
and
it's a very low bar. It's, yeah, a very low bar to clear. But you know what? The plaintiffs started it all back in the Hawaii case in the 90s when the Hawaii Supreme Court took on same-sex marriage. And the plaintiffs in that case, the gay couples, their attorneys argued, well, we're at least as good as the worst of you. That's where this whole thing started, for in my mind anyway, this whole back and forth about whose studies are better. The reality, though, is that, again, we have millennia of human experience. The gay experience.
We have millennia of
human experience
that tells us what?
That tells us that a male-female married couple raising children benefits the state. In other words, it creates less dependence, with a T, less dependence on the state than in any other kind of family structure that you would want to create.
But isn't it also possible that since human societies have not been accepting of homosexuals getting together and being parents, that you could also create the same sort of argument?
Well, only if you assume that it's the animus that has blocked the flourishing of homosexuals throughout millennia. I just don't think that's so. I know that there has always been this moral, immoral attitude throughout millennia. I get that. But surely, after a couple thousand years, there would be certain human experiences where homosexuality would have been allowed to flourish and proven itself somehow, some way, somewhere, in terms of familial relationships that could be pointed to. And there just isn't. And so we have this very short window. There's no real longitudinal studies of gay parenting. It just hasn't gone on that long. So,
do you think that same-sex couples can be ideal parents, can be good parents, can produce good kids?
I think that people in, quote, loving, committed relationships can take care of other people. I believe that. There's nothing in my mind that says that homosexuality intrinsically devalues somebody as a person in the sense of taking care of another human being. But the state interest is not about just you and me deciding we're going to adopt a kid from Nigeria and send him money and go visit and love him and we're committed to him and all that. The state interest is much more than that, and that's that comprehensive union that I was just describing.
Let me ask you this finally.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard this. People are saying, Paul, you're on the wrong end of history.
Yeah.
This train has left the station a long time ago. You see the exponential support. You may argue the actual studies themselves, but they're people saying, look, it's people, you know, they resisted it in the past. Yeah. A new generation is coming.
What's the point? Let's just let it flow naturally then. Why should any court, especially a one-man court, decide when that moment in time is that something is valid?
But do you think
valid?
It is? Okay, that's okay. Point taken. But but do you agree with that it's coming no matter what you can do? Do you see it coming? 5 years, it's going to be the law of the land. 10 years, it's going to be the law. I mean, do you see it as inevitable?
No, I don't. And I can point to Roe v. Wade. You know, somebody could have said in 1973 or 1972, abortion on demand, legalized, is inevitable. We get a court case, it is. But here we are today where you know, the next appointed justice is still in question, is still a huge debate. Why? It's not because of some other issue. It's because of abortion. And so here we are 40 years later, still arguing something that we thought was settled. And this is one of the, and I'll make this point quickly, it's one of the last points I have made with the state legal team. Win or lose, win or lose at the 10th Circuit and then win or lose at the Supreme Court, it's important to have a deep, rich, comprehensive argument so that the voice of the people can understand what the argument is. I don't think the state did that in the Shelby hearing, but I do think in this briefing that they have.
It's Paul Merrow. He is president of the Sutherland Institute, a conservative policy think tank based in Salt Lake City, co-author of a book called The Natural Family, a Manifesto. Paul, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, always.
We're going to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the state of Utah's evolving case on gay marriage. It seems the state's legal team has come up with a strategy, a new focus, to challenge the ruling that found Utah's gay marriage law is unconstitutional. One of the focuses is going to be children, and the case is children simply fare better in homes where they have a mother and a father. So we're talking about the legal aspect, but also that social science part there as well. Joining us on the program is Clifford Roski. He's a professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. His work focuses on children and LGBT families. He's also chair of the board of directors of Equality Utah, we should mention. That's an LGBT rights group. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with, I'm anxious to get into the question that Paul Merrow posed, which is, what is the state's interest in same-sex marriage? Do you want to take that on?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's actually an easy question. It's about, just as the state says, caring for children and making sure that parents stay together, who love each other, make a commitment to be in a monogamous relationship and to care for the children that they bring into the marriage and to support one another.
What do you make of his the case that he's making, this liberty ideal, the What do you make of it? I mean, it's an interesting argument, I suppose. It's not grounded, Merrow's part anyway, in social science or anything like that.
Yeah, I would say it's hard to follow. I think the phrase ordered liberty, the Supreme Court has used it and then has made fun of the phrase itself. It doesn't seem to have a lot of specific content. I mean, the question in these cases is quite simple. The state has to provide a reason for refusing to let same-sex couples marry each other. A reason. And so what's the reason? Ordered liberty is not a particularly satisfying response. We could have a conversation about procreation and parenting, and that becomes a more interesting conversation.
Because it's more pragmatic.
Well, we understand what it is, yeah. So we can define it.
The other one's more abstract.
Yeah, extremely abstract. Yeah. It's hard to imagine something, liberty. I mean, of course, liberty is precisely what the same-sex couples are asserting in the case. They want the freedom or the liberty to marry each other and raise children together.
So evaluate the state's case, if you would. I mean, you've called it kind of a rehash of some of the older stereotypes in place that it's and we should point this out. I've been sort of talking about that the state has ditched the procreation argument. And you pointed out they haven't gotten rid of it. It's still a part of it. It's just, I guess they've shifted focus.
Honestly, it seems to me that they've pulled it apart. They used to call it the responsible procreation argument. Well, that's actually a reference to parenting, right? That it's not about just procreating, but responsibly taking care of children. And now they have a straight-up procreation argument that legalizing same-sex marriage would decrease birth rates. That is extensively briefed now. And then also that, as you talked about, that heterosexual married couples, the state claims, are simply the best parents there are, and that same-sex couples are inferior as parents. That actually, biological parents, they say, are the best, and then sort of second best would be any male-female couple, and then any other kind of couple would be not optimal, not the A, but some lesser grade.
I wonder whether, not without evaluating the quality of the argument, does it make sense as a strategy? Is the state, does this make sense from all the things they have to choose from? Does this make some legal sense in that way?
Well, they're out of good options at this point. This issue started in the early 70s. It's been briefed extensively in dozens and dozens of courts. And so the state's brief does not include anything new, but it does include the two arguments that until about 10 years ago, were successful in courts, and those are the procreation and parenting arguments. Until about 10 years ago, because I think judges were not really familiar with the literature on same-sex parents and didn't know anyone who was a same-sex parent, they were willing to buy these arguments that, same-sex couples can't procreate and therefore can't bring children into their union and also are not as good at parenting. Of course, back then, there were also stereotypes about gay people being child molesters and things like this.
The question of procreation, Shelby seemed to sort of dismiss that kind of out of hand. Did he not? That part of it?
Well, you know, out of hand suggests that there may or may not have been reasons behind it. I don't think it was an emotional decision. He put quite clearly to the state in very blunt terms, well, if marriage is about procreation, then why do we let people who either don't want to procreate or can't procreate marry? And the state offered no response to that. So
didn't he ask them to make a response? Wasn't he asking them to sort of offer something?
He said, would it be constitutional to ban people from marrying if they either won't have children or can't have children? And the state said, well, we would never do that. And he said, I didn't ask you if you would. I want to know if you could. And they admitted that that was unconstitutional. And so it's hard to make sense of this argument that marriage is about procreation if it's not a precondition in any sense.
Before we get to social science, I wanted to ask you whether how much of this case is going to come down to states' rights? Not so much the social science part, not so much the procreation part, but the essential right that a state has to make its own determinations related to marriage.
I actually think zero of this case will come down to states' rights. And this is a big misunderstanding about what the Supreme Court did last summer. When the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, it had two options before it. It could have said that DOMA violated states' rights, that states have the unlimited authority to define marriage. Or the court could have said it violates the equal protection rights of same-sex couples. The court talked a lot about states' rights, but in the end, that's not why the Defense of Marriage Act was struck down. And the court was very clear on this. It was struck down because it violated the equal dignity of same-sex couples and the children they're raising. The court said that it's true that states traditionally have the authority to define marriage, but any state definition of marriage, like any state law, must respect the United States Constitution. And they cited to the famous case of Loving versus Virginia, where Virginia banned interracial marriage. And they said, we have the authority to define marriage. And the Supreme Court said, well, you can have a definition, but it can't violate the federal constitution. And they struck that definition down. So there's no question that the federal constitution applies to state laws governing marriage.
So it's going to boil down to what, do you think, this case?
Well, so I do think it's going to boil down to whether the state can finally provide a reason for excluding same-sex couples from marriage. That is, there at times the state seems to be under the mistaken impression that it could prevail by showing that it's good for heterosexuals to marry. Almost all of their arguments point in this direction. They talk about what's so great about allowing heterosexuals to marry. As you point out, all their studies are comparing heterosexual marriages to other non-marriage among heterosexuals, divorce and step-parents. But I don't think that that's going to get them over the hump. They need to be able to show a reason for excluding same-sex couples, not allowing heterosexuals. I mean, it sounds obvious when you say it, but Amendment 3 doesn't let heterosexuals marry. It stops same-sex couples from marrying. If they don't have a reason for that, then they're going to lose.
Which comes down to they're going to have to marshal social science to make the case.
Something, yes. I mean, some sort of speculation. I mean, this brief makes some pretty bold claims. At some point, it says that Amendment 3 might encourage parents to forgo alcohol and drugs, to avoid extramarital affairs, to avoid excessive work hours and time-consuming hobbies that would take them away from their children. This is, I think, rather speculative and rather hard to follow what the logic is between the connection between banning same-sex couples from marrying and influencing people's choices about
drugs.
Do they
connect that to any kind of science?
No, they say that child-centered marriage is more selfless. It's a argument based on what they call logic, not science. I mean, there's certainly no science to support any of that. I mean, as you point out, all of the none of the studies that the state cites, and they cite many dozens, none of the studies actually include children who were raised by same-sex parents. It's sort of a breathtaking omission.
I mean, that I want you to sort of underscore that. Yeah. The science that they're presenting, none of it. It's heterosexual couples who are, for the most part, healthy compared to dysfunctional heterosexual couples or couples who are not married, single people. So gay parents, they're not in the mix in these studies.
Yeah, and I think 98% of the studies don't include same-sex parents at all whatsoever. So as you said, they're comparing married heterosexuals to single parents, step-parents, divorced parents, and even parents who cheat on each other, parents who, infidelity. There are two studies where there's only two in which they even claim to describe gay and lesbian parents, but they're clearly not describing either gay and lesbian parents or children who were raised by them. So, for example, in one of these studies, they ask adult children, was your parent ever in a same-sex relationship when you were a child? And some of them said yes.
Well, that would have meant daddy was cheating.
And indeed, when you then look at the data, it's perfectly clear that that child was in a heterosexual marriage. That is, their mother and father were married to each other. And one of those parents, you know, stepped outside the marriage with a person of the same sex. To compare that to what the author calls intact heterosexual married families, it's just what it proves is that divorce and infidelity are bad for children, which is, of course, not relevant to this case at all and not surprising.
Let's get another voice involved in the conversation. Judith Stacey is joining us, a professor emerita of sociology at New York University. Her most recent book is called Unhitched, Love, Marriage, and Family Values. Makes her home in California, so she's joining us today from the studios of UC Berkeley School of Journalism. And Judith Stacey, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Let me also mention that Judith Stacey has endorsed numerous legal briefs in support of same-sex marriage. However, her research has been used by both advocates and opponents of same-sex marriage to support their differing opinions. I wanted to get that out of the way. Judith Stacey, to this question of science, is there enough science, or good science anyway, to help us settle this matter of the essential question of whether gay parents can be good parents in comparison to heterosexual parents?
I don't think the decisions will actually be based on social science. I don't think they really are. I think social science is always drawn into another set of social and political pressures and concerns. But at this point, yes, I think on the way you phrased the question, there is good enough social science to make very clear that many same-sex couples parent at least as well as equivalent heterosexual parents. I think the research is pretty well established on that now.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about that as we go, but I wanted to get back. What do you mean? You don't think social science is going to be the thing that's going to really determine all of this? Why?
No, I don't think it ever really does. I mean, I actually think I think you can demonstrate that, the very same social science at one point in time will receive a receptive audience or not according to political and social context. And so I don't actually think it's the social science that's definitive, but I think it has a role to play. And especially when there is enormous consensus among social scientists, then it can play a role. But the social science is always very complicated and doesn't address the question the way it's posed by the court.
Yeah. You say that there are arguments, in fact, that could be made by the state against same-sex marriage, whether they're compelling or not is one thing. But you say there are some studies that show same-sex marriage could, you know, diminish, for example, the significance of some heterosexual men. You could make the argument.
No, I didn't say that. I said I don't think they've – I mean, I don't think you can find studies that would – Well, finish your sentence.
Sorry. I'm misstating it. What I'm trying to say is that there could be an argument made, mm-hmm. for example, that two women make the best parents or two men make
right.
the best parents.
Right.
But let me leave that heterosexual men part out of there for a moment. But you
right.
said you wouldn't make either of those statements.
Well, I would actually, I actually have suggested that it's possible that future studies will find that on average, two men wind up being the best parents, counterintuitively, but that isn't because they're gay or because they're men. It has to do with the level of selection that goes into what a small pool that is compared to everyone else and the other things. So it's what social scientists call selection effects. And so you can make all kinds of claims, is what I'm saying, without really understanding what the social science is actually telling you. Because it does turn out, and I predict that same-sex male couple who are parents will actually have lower divorce rates than anyone else. So that's there's not enough data yet to nowhere near enough data to document that. But there is some small amount of data and there is some logic. But I wouldn't want to make that case.
Yeah.
But I'm saying I can imagine that happening.
Does gender matter? You hear that question all the time. The question, of course, will come up in terms of social science, that it's the ideal situation is mom and dad. You know, mom with I'll just give the sort of stereotypical sort of knee-jerk impression. Mom has the softer tones. Dad has the rougher edges. And in order to create a, you know, healthy kid, you've got to have both of those in equal measure.
Right. Well, there is no evidence that that's true. I mean, I actually, with my former colleague when I was at University of Southern California, Tim Biblars, we actually published an article in 2010 called How Does the Gender of Parents Matter? Mm-hmm. And we looked at all of the research we could find that could possibly get at that question. And you can never answer it perfectly because you can't study that question. The best you can, because you don't have, you know, it's not a laboratory where you can assign children to different kinds of family types the way you want to and decide whether this parent's going to play rough and tumble and this one isn't and, you know, that sort of thing. So all you could do is look at the studies that compare children who have a single mother with children who have a single father. Now, that's after a divorce.
Yeah.
Children don't wind up equally in those two groups because there are certain patterns that would lead to a father getting custody that are different from leading to a mother getting custody. And in other words, it's always very, very difficult. But anyway, we studied that. We looked at the literature on same-sex parenting versus heterosexual couple parents. There are some very, very good, well-controlled studies now that compare fairly well-matched groups of, and I don't like to say opposite sex ever. I say different sex because I think there's a really serious flaw in the notion that the genders are opposite each other. There is much greater similarity between two educated heterosexual parents of a certain class than there is between all women parents and all men parents. And in fact, there are much greater differences in parenting styles and approaches to discipline and to all kinds of things by social class and religion and other factors than there is between men and women as two exclusive groups. So I think it's really very shoddy thinking and poor social science to imagine you could compare all men and all women as parents and come out with two very different portraits.
Seems like people are looking for blanket statements, and I guess they're not really, you can't really find them. They're hard to find.
Well, because people aren't like that. In other words, I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah.
We can, you know, if you're looking for generalization, you know, a very typical example is it's certainly true on one level to say that men are taller than women, but it doesn't take very much thought to realize that lots of women are taller than lots of men.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, on average differences tell you something that may be true in some ways that are interesting, but they don't tell you at all about who can or can't be a good parent or a good basketball player or anything else. And, yeah, I think the search for these, you know, sort of social scientific exclusive truths is really unfortunate.
Mm. Professor Husky?
Judith, you know the science so much better than I do, but I do think, I wonder if this is a correct understanding of that literature. Earlier, the previous guest said that there were no longitudinal studies of same-sex parents, that we don't know how a same-sex couples parent. And my understanding is that, you know, it's been 30 years and there have been probably close to 100 studies now. And many of them are longitudinal and have increasingly large sample sizes, and that every single one of the studies of children raised by same-sex parents shows no deficit in psychological or social functioning as compared to heterosexual parents. Is that true?
It's not exactly true, but it's close enough to true. It's there are debates among some people about what certain studies show. There are not yet a lot of longitudinal studies that have any comparison groups. The only real, like, full life course longitudinal study of that sort that I'm fully aware of is Nanette Gartrell's, and now she's comparing with Henny Boos in the Netherlands, that have actually, very presciently started following chosen lesbian parenting from pregnancy. And those children are now, maybe about, I think they might be approaching age 20 or something, many of them. And she's followed them. But of course, she didn't have a comparison group. So you can certainly learn. What you can say unequivocally is that plenty of these children are turning out absolutely swell. and so we know that gays and lesbians can parent over the long haul and turn out good children. And given that many, many states allow convicted felons to be parents, and, it seems like the bar is completely ridiculous on that score. So that much we can say. It's also true that there are no studies that unequivocally show a deficit in same-sex parenting versus different-sex parenting. There are little findings here and there that people can argue about, but about whether this is an advantage or a disadvantage and things of that sort. But basically, I would say what you said is mainly right, but I wouldn't say it quite as, put it in blanket terms quite like that.
It's interesting. There's a study that's being referenced, and I'm guessing the state will be using it from the University of Texas.
The Regnerus study, I'm sure. It's going to be the Regnerus study you're going
to
mention?
Yes, it is. And I wanted to get your reaction to that, your sense of that.
Yeah.
Professor Roski, you too.
Well, that's the one that Professor Roski was referencing.
That's right. Judith, talk a little bit about that, Judith Stacey.
Yeah, this is a study that's pretty much been decimated by social scientists, but this was a study. Regnerus is a sociologist at the University of Texas, and there was a study, it's called the Family Structure Study, something like that, and it was financed by a number of right-wing anti-same-sex marriage foundations, and it drew together a panel of people to study the significance of family structure, which comes back to the argument you were hearing from your prior guest, Paul Merrill, about he's arguing that it's the state's interest is in a structure.
Yeah.
So I think there is a connection there to the way that was framed. And this is the study that Professor Roski was referencing, in which he tried to claim that the prior studies had too small sample sizes and weren't rigorous enough. So it's a quantitative study that has a large sample size, but what they did is they don't really have a definition of same-sex parenting. It's just what he said. They did a survey of young adults and asked how many of them had a parent who had ever had a same-sex relationship while they were a child. And this is hardly a definition of gay parenting. And then they did some statistical manipulations that are also very complicated and have been challenged as well to argue that those children were disadvantaged. But, of course, they didn't he even says in this study, if you read it carefully, there are a lot of on the one hands, on the other hands. So it's a very problematic study, and it created a huge furor when it was published because the referee process was compromised as well. A couple of the advisors of the study were the reviewers for the journal that published it, and it's been a major brouhaha.
Do you want to say anything about that study?
Just a sort of a broader point, which is that all of the arguments in the state's briefs were presented to the United States Supreme Court last summer as justifications for the Defense of Marriage Act. And instead of finding that the Defense of Marriage Act protected children, the court found that it demeaned same-sex couples, harmed the children they were raising, and indeed humiliated tens of thousands of children being raised by same-sex couples, because it told them that their parents were not as good as other parents. And that's exactly what this brief does. That's exactly what this law does. It's for these purposes, indistinguishable from the Defense of Marriage Act.
Were you surprised by the passion in Justice Kennedy's statement about that? It seemed quite, not personal, but pretty engaged.
Yes, I was a little surprised, in particular because much of the opinion seems to read as if they wanted to hold off on the constitutionality of state laws against same-sex marriage. But I think that once you say that laws that discourage same-sex marriage humiliate tens of thousands of children, you've tipped your hand as to what's mm-hmm. coming next. I think there's no coming. You can't say, well, Amendment 3 humiliates children. However, there's nothing that follows from however. You can't humiliate children.
Well, not the way the state's making its case, right?
Absolutely. That's right. To say that giving an A to one set of parents doesn't demean other parents, the Supreme Court has already spoken on that issue.
Right. The other thing I would say is your prior guest really could not come up with a state interest in excluding same-sex couples from marriage. I think I could do a better job than he did if that were my interest, but it is not. But the fact is that the idea that somehow, I mean, in fact, you can make a much stronger argument, although I think there are problems here too, with why the state would even be supporting marriage. In fact, one of the critiques from those who are critical of marriage is that the same-sex marriage movement excludes all kinds of other parenting, and I'm actually very sympathetic to that argument.
Yeah, that there's class inequality here going on?
That's right. And in fact, I have suggested in my book that ironically and unintentionally, expanding, legalizing same-sex marriage, while it'll improve equality of opportunity for same-sex couples, it expands class and race inequality because marriage has always been an unequal occupational endeavor and has a long history of discrimination and inequality, and I think an inevitable one. So I think that would actually be a more persuasive case, but it wouldn't go in the direction they wish to go. And the other argument, I think, is a serious one, is about that is relevant to Utah, is the question of polygamy, plural marriage.
It's that slippery slope, I guess, that that Justice Scalia was talking about.
And he was right.
Yeah.
I mean, not right, and I don't think his conclusion was right, but he's right.
This opens the door.
It's not that this opens the door. The door is open. In other
right.
words, once you use that argument, once you use love and commitment as the basis for your definition, then you've opened the door is open. But that doesn't mean that people walk through. You have to have lots of other things to make it through that door.
Yeah, we're essentially out of time. But Professor, let me ask you this finally. You seem pretty confident that this is the state's argument's not going to work at all.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the precise same arguments have been presented again and again, and they've been failing pretty miserably in the courts for at least the last 5 years, and most spectacularly failed before the United States Supreme Court, you know, just months ago. And so to repeat these same arguments, I don't blame the state for doing so. They're the only arguments that have ever won. But at one point, the judge asked the state, what's the harm of letting same-sex couples marry? And the attorney general said, we just simply don't know. And I think that says it all.
It's Professor Clifford Roski, law professor at the University of Utah, board member of Equality Utah. Thank you, Professor, for being with us.
Thank you.
And Judith Stacy, author of the book Unhitched, Love, Marriage, and Family Values. Judith Stacy, thanks
from
to you.
From West Hollywood to Western China.
Yes.
There's more to the title.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry, we should have plugged that in. We'll put a link to it. How's that on our website?
Very good.
Thanks very much. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.